Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening.
You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Not spoke to you for a crazily long amount
Six
of time,
years,
but it,
yeah,
but it's a pleasure to speak to you, Jason. I know we say that to hosts and that, but it genuinely is. So I've been looking forward to this all week.
That's really nice. And speaking, since you mentioned the word host, that makes it easy to seg into what I wanted to say at the very start, which is a kind of a proposal for you. Or it might seem like that. I propose that we, although we're recording this conversation, that we keep it informal and just as a conversation between us, and then at the end we can just discuss whether we want to use it or not.
Yeah, sure, absolutely, yeah. As long as we don't start talking about, you know, our sex life and whiskey habits or whatever.
Right,
then
I didn't suggest this as a reason to go into, you know... Personal details or small talk or anything like that, but just so that we can be free and not feel
absolutely.
We're performing for some public out there.
No, absolutely. And you know what? With each passing year, my attitude is that I wouldn't say anything privately in a room with one person that I wouldn't say publicly. So it's kind of a little practice I've been trying out that. I have a friend who does that, and I was been quite impressed with it. So personal things have played a growing role in my work, as I say, with each passing year or whatever. So, yeah, I'm very, very happy to do that indeed.
Right. Well, it's kind of the aim of this podcast, or one of them, is just that to, for me personally, it's not to make the podcast, but to experience a connection with another living soul, another sentient being, as you once described me. The podcast is the pretext for that. Like, you and I wouldn't be connecting just to shoot the shit. It wouldn't happen. Well, actually, this is kind of interesting as part in this context, is when I emailed you, I didn't email to ask you on the podcast. I just emailed to reach out and see what was up. But you offered to. And congruent with that, a couple of people right in the similar time said, what about Kramer, what about Kramer? So I thought, okay, there's an opening, there's a sign, and so we are actually connecting as if it's to do a podcast. But
yeah, well, I didn't know you were doing a podcast again, but having seen the website after you made contact, I had a look and thought, oh, right, you know. And it's all got, as I said earlier, a fresh look and interesting sounding, and just so many people have said over time... you know, some of my favourite interviews have been when you spoke to that Jason person. And I'm like, yeah, and they're like, what's he doing? I said, well, he's an interesting character. You'll have to go and have a look for yourself. I'm not entirely sure. So I think to some people it might sound that we probably talk often, but as you said, we don't. So, I'd happy to add my two penneth to your project, and thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, it wasn't, as I say, I'm not having you.
You're not having me.
No, I mean,
what's
a
relief.
I'm not the host, and this is the liminal thing.
Yes, you're not a host. I'm not a guest. This isn't a podcast. It's just two guys saying things.
Yeah, and if that happens, that's great for other people to actually participate in that.
As
flies on the wall. And in the larger context, which I think will bring us to the subject you suggested that we do talk about, which is really I'm totally down with this podcast. And it took me a long time to come back to podcasting for many different reasons. I was quite conscious that I did not want to be participating in the alternate perceptions community, like in the time that you and I have spoken. One of the things that's changed, and you pretty much zeroed in on it when you were talking about my website, is that I've come to see what I do as being an artist. Like, I'm an artist, who sounds so pretentious when I have to say it, but in terms of having to, how I see what I do, it's a creative process, self-exploration, yes. It is a, you know, an individuatory path and all of that. I'm still interested in the same subject, but the context that I actually want it to be seen in is as an artwork and as an art project, as opposed to a disseminator of information / teacher. Yep. And so I was particularly conscious that I didn't want to reach out to too many of the, quote, usual suspects, unquote, within the alternative perceptions community, even knowing that that was going to be a large part of my audience.
Yeah.
For reasons that I think we'll get to go into today. So you're an exception, and that's not meant to blow smoke up your ass. That's just to give you some sort of context.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, I see exactly what you're saying, and if I were to do... Well, I do a podcast, but mine's just, you know, me monologues, basically. But if I were to do it, I would do the same thing, and I'd be conscious that my list of guests would not be the same people that you'd see on, you know, Coast to Coast. Mm-hmm. And so people talking about pyramids and UFOs and banking collapses and stuff. Not necessarily. But as you say, there's always a few figures who sort of cross over. But I think one thing you and I do have in common, if I may suggest, is that personal development is pretty central to what we do. And in my work, I think although I do speak to, let's call it the underground mainstream from time to time, my audience is small and niche and sort of quite loyal and excellent. It's not the sort of thing where there's hundreds of thousands of people like some characters. It's just not what I do that, and I just, my heart wouldn't be in that. So I've just slowly, organically built my audience over, I don't know, 10 years or so. And it is very singular what I do, and I've come to enjoy it more and become better at it, if I don't say so myself, the more singular it becomes. So I'm not trying to do what anyone else is doing. I don't want it to look or sound like anyone else. So it's purposefully championing individualism, you know, championing this singular aspect to say, look how different I can do this and not be an asshole or pompous with it, but just enjoy, to use your image, the artistry of it. So my unfolding process of me and my perceptions is just a canvas, and it's not even really very valuable, but it's mine, and I enjoy exploring it. And sometimes I record those things. So I might talk to people, I might make notes about things, I might wander around and make recordings of that and share them. And so Neil Kramer is just a project about that stuff. But as you say, my desire to disseminate and be a clearinghouse and push campaigns and stuff really finished many, many years ago. I have no desire to do that. None. So I hear what you're saying. And the people I enjoy in the field, which are few and far between, I have to say, we'll come to that, they're also doing it. So I like to see people who are walking the talk. I don't just want to talk to researchers and scholars. They just bore me and disappoint me. And that's my own problem, no one else's. But when I see someone who's actually making changes and doing stuff, taking action, that to me is dead exciting and inspirational. And if that person happens to write books or say things and record it, great. But it's very, very rare, you know. Mm. And it's become increasingly rare as time's gone by.
I'm going to ask you a personal question now, quite a very personal one, because they say nothing more personal than money. Are you able to make a living doing your thing now, being Neil Kramer, to quote yourself?
Yes, I am.
That's what I figured, yeah.
And I'll tell you why, though. It's not media, books and downloads and things like that, because if it was just that, the answer would be no. The reason is because I made the decision 10 years ago that the part of what I do that was most enjoyable was working with people. So I put myself forward as a sort of consulting philosopher. Not in a, again, a grand sense. I think, I would hope you would know this, but for the listeners perhaps, just as somebody who naturally is thoughtful and has gained a little bit of insight and has a knack for articulation. And I felt that there was a lot of people who didn't have any element of that in their life who might want to pay for it and engage somebody in the same way that you would somebody to teach you yoga or somebody to help you with nutrition. You know, someone who knows about that and facilitates a process. So that really is my living. Mm-hmm. So I assist people in their conscious development and spiritual growth to the best of my abilities, and don't really put myself forward as an amazing guru or teacher or earth-shattering, you know, point of illumination. Just a guy who is thoughtful and quite disciplined and yet grounded. And so that is how it works as a living, to be quite frank with you. Mm-hmm. So if I look at the end of the year when I go and give my paperwork to the tax people so they submit it on the computer, you know, when I look down the columns, the one that makes it work is that. There's the consultative element.
Yeah, I would have guessed that. And is it is a large part of that returning clients?
Yeah. I speak to quite a large number of people, and some of them I speak to like once a quarter, some of them once a month, right. Some of them just once. And that's fine, you know, it's not like defined by how regularly you speak to them. Some people come with a specific issue. They've arrived at a crossroads and they've heard me speak, hopefully with some sincerity and wisdom a little bit. I think, yeah, it would be nice to get his view on that. And that's it. And they might pay me for that. And then that's it. They're out of there. Mm. So, yeah, that is good. The other thing I'd decided was that publishing is fucking dead. And it's just impossible. And the bloke who was my, quote, agent, who got us a book deal for when I wrote The Unfoldment in 2012, a book, he said that the publishing industry really sort of died in the late 90s. And as technology came about, it changed how that works. And it's very difficult to make a living writing books. However, if you can offer media that supports that, that can be more interesting. So again, I made a sort of conscious decision, not as a businessman, because I'm a very poor businessman, Jason, I'll tell you.
I was just thinking that Neil has a real business head.
No, honestly, no. I've worked in business, and it was not a flourishing thing for me, to put it mildly. Mm. I enjoyed the work, but as soon as I moved into a management and business role, no, it fell to pieces. It's not good. I'm not a businessman. I've had business managers look at what I do and say, wow, you know, this is great. You must be making millions. And I'm like, no, this is what I'm making. They're like, oh my God.
But you know, your site is super professional looking. Like, I was really quite wowed by that.
Oh, thank you, Jason.
Element of that. I didn't necessarily mean that as a compliment, by the way.
Oh, did you
nudge, know? Nudge, wink, wink. But oh. It just really, it is. It does look like it was designed by or for a CEO of an Enlightenment Incorporated kind of thing.
Well, I'll take that as a backhanded something.
Something,
or
other. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to set myself on fire. I know you don't believe me, but I ain't no liar. For there is so much hatred in this world. Fuck it, I'ma set the world on fire. And when I gets where I wanna be, gonna whip out my dick and piss on your fire. Oh my God, my dick's on fire. This situation's mighty dire. I took my dick to the doctor and he said,
yeehaw!
Boy, you got third-degree burns on your little head. One more time now, oh my God, my dick's on fire. This situation's mighty dire. I took my dick to the doctor and he said, boy, you got third-degree burns on your little head.
I'd rather have a day of nothingness in my calendar than an exciting day, you know, on Madison Avenue, any day of the week, any day, when I just wander down to the sandwich shop. You know, that's a day of success for me.
Still, I mean, making a living doing what you're doing by whatever means, I mean, doing what you feel is in your heart to do, that's a very rare achievement.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad of it, and it does feel like, as our Buddhist friends say, right livelihood. I can't think of a much better way of doing it for me, where the money is, you know, decent money. It's not blood money. I'm not exploiting stuff much. It's just, you know, PayPal and the banks or whatever. And when you take them out of it, it's an honest, clear, skillful product and people who enjoy listening to it. Thank you very much, you know.
Well, I'm going to try and be as honest as I can with you, as I always am with everyone. But also kind of self-revealing, transparent is the word. It's hard, easy to say and then hard to do. Like one of the things that I've had around your work, I think, is basically envy. Like, oh, Neil's doing what I would like to be doing and he's succeeding. Like he's got his insights and he's put them together into a kind of coherent system and he's able to sell them and he's able to sell himself as a kind of teacher. And hey, why aren't I being as successful as Neil? Right? That's one of the things going on there that I say is quite difficult to say for me. The other thing that is inseparable from this is that I did get reasonably close to this within the days of Aeolus Cephas and even post-Aeolus, post-Stormy Weather, which, as you may recall, I actually dismantled or ended Stormy Weather partly because it was being successful, not because it wasn't. But then Sweater, you know, continued as a result, largely as a result of Stormy Weather and the interest I was able to create Sweater, the Stormy Weather existential agency. And that, you know, I was able to make a living off that. So in my own way, I had combined these, you know, the various media in such a way that I could create a platform from which to earn a living. However, what happened was that I became aware of the degree to which my own unconscious motives were determining, you know, my actions, the compromising, I should say, and the extent to which I'm going to oversimplify now, but the extent to which I was using the experience of being a teacher and being a guide and having a kind of systematized knowledge base, which is around existential detection, pattern recognition, identity deconstruction, etc., and a lot of it was informed, as you may know, or some of it, by this teacher, John De Ruyter.
Yes, indeed.
And so congruent with beginning to discover things about him that seemed suspect, that he, as a charismatic leader, was perhaps abusing his power in certain ways, I actually began to see in myself matching patterns, which no doubt had drawn me to him in the first place, where I was doing the same. Being inflated, feeling more powerful, feeling like my life had meaning and purpose by helping, quote unquote, others and making a living doing it. So what seemed like a really sweet deal or a really sweet setup, I began to see was sort of laced with strychnine, you know, the milk that I was giving others and the milk that I was imbibing from others was tainted. And so I did what I do, you know, which is also part of my pattern. I dismantled everything and I announced, you know, I came clean. I confessed my sins to my public. And so here I am, you know, 5 years later, and basically, I mean, circumstances have been kind. I inherited from my mother's passing enough to buy a house, and now I'm renovating that house, which was actually, I bought it for land. It was demolition condition. It was an old crack house. I'd like to get into this maybe a bit later in the metaphorical process and the enactment that this is psychologically, but anyway, renovating this old dilapidated demolition condition crack house has been this most wow. incredible journey for me, but also yeah. it's been I've some degree of stability. I have a mortgage now, so there's pressure on me.
Oh, Jason, know, I'm a in mortgage. That.
Yeah, exactly.
How dare you ever accuse me of being a professional or grown up? Well, a mortgage, Jason.
Didn't accuse you of being grown
just,
up.
I'll just write that a mortgage. Yeah. Just underline that he's yeah, got a mortgage.
Yeah, totally. Right. So
well, that make me feel slightly better if I get one. If you've got one, it can't be too bad.
So
yes,
so this is
you
see this is all sort of interconnected. That right. I had to let go of my dream of being this great spiritual teacher and guide, and just knuckle down and be a guy who's hammering nails and learning to do plumbing. And actually, I'm a lot happier for it. But I still look at what Neil's doing, and I think, that could be me. But I also think, whew, thank God, that could have been me.
Jason, you know, I said I was looking forward to this. This is exactly why. Because there are many things I admire about you, and I hope it doesn't make you feel uncomfortable to be openly complimented, but...
It does.
It does.
Yeah, okay. But go ahead, I can take it. Yeah.
The number one thing, however, is you're just astonishing, as you call it, transparency. No one is ever going to say to anybody on a public recording between two well-known figures, I have felt envy about your work. So I just take my hat off you to say that. And I also immediately just am puzzled by it, because it's so idiosyncratic what I do. And I've turned down so many opportunities for wealth and association, fame by association. You know, come and do a show with this guy, or come and do a tour with this guy. If I told you those, you'd laugh and think, right, I'll tell you what keeps it real for me is that this isn't really how I define myself. So if I was on my deathbed or there was a gravestone etched, I wouldn't have anything to do with this, really. I don't really think of it like that. Mine is just how I've become more fulfilled in myself. And what I do helps a little bit to facilitate that, but it doesn't constitute it. So my relationships and my connection with my environment is what fulfills me. And I've done that better in the States than I have in the UK, and it's had nothing to do with, quote, my work. And I mean nothing. So my happiness on a week-by-week basis is rather unrelated to my work. And my growth is tracked in the work a little bit. And if people listen to me 10 years ago, I sound like a douchebag compared to now. But it's a journey, and it's a process, and it's all legitimate, even when we're unwise and insensitive. It's still legitimate, you know, a bad feeling or a good feeling. They're all legitimate feelings. And so for me, I don't know, I think I might have said this to you a long time ago, coming from the north of England, which, you know, European listeners may know this, but it's a very pragmatic place, and you're encouraged never to, as we used to say, get too far up your own arse. And so to trumpet yourself or to grandstand is really harshly looked down upon immediately by your friends who, quote, love you. Just say, who the fuck do you think you are? Shut up. Go and get us a pint, you know. And I was brought up in that environment. So when I was a teenager, you know, I was playing guitar and we were playing band. I was in a band and we were playing crappy little places and stuff. And it was a teaching in humility, really. And that's never entirely left me. So now and again, if I do appear in a nice venue, like I did a TV show the other day, or I'm going to this lovely, interesting Omega Institute, and it's a nice environment, and it's interesting to work in those places, but I never feel part of it, never. And I don't think this is me, this is what I am, or this is what I deserve, or anything. I don't. I'm always like looking at myself from the third person, thinking, look at you doing this funny thing. Anyway, what's for dinner? And I just have this impossibly detached perspective from it where, and I'll be honest with you, it makes me miss a lot of opportunities for, quote, fame and fortune, because I'm just not that way inclined. I can't spot opportunities. And where there's an available point to, say, network with somebody who's influential, I will actively turn the other way, not out of some principle or ideal, just because it's not in my nature to do that. So I've noticed that the quality of my work has maintained a level of growth because I'm not having to compromise like anything, really. No one's ever come to me and said, don't talk about this, or raise this topic and, you know, diminish this topic. No one's said that. I talk about whatever the hell I like, and that maintains a freshness to it. But yeah, from that point, it's just been establishing, you know, Neil Cramer's way of doing things, which is hard to put a label on a little bit. I use the word philosophy because it's a friendlier word than mystic, which sounds a little bit pompous. It's hard to say that with a straight face. But mysticism is more what I've been interested in from really teenage years. So I'd say, you know, philosophy for living is a little catchphrase that I invented to say what I'm doing is giving you models and thoughts and perspectives on how to fulfill yourself a bit more and express yourself a bit more genuinely. And that's it. And if you don't like it, fuck off. And if you do, great. But it doesn't hugely affect me what people say or think or feel, not much. It does a little bit. Anyone who says it doesn't is lying, but it's not much. And I think that's a part of it. And perhaps you'd, you know, as an intellectual sensitive man, we all have to find strategies to not be bothered what other people think about us and how we're perceived and how we're acknowledged. I was just talking to somebody last night about acknowledgement. And I think for me, I have slowly learned that the only acknowledgement of my work is fucking me, is myself, that at the end of the week or the month or the year, I can look back and think, you know, that was pretty good. Kramer, what you did there, that was a nice little piece, or that was a good poem, or when you met with that guy, it was good, and he went away feeling more capable. Well done. Now, go and have a cup of tea. And that's it, period. That's the fucking end of it. That's my acknowledgement. What somebody says somewhere on a screen is kind of bollocks, really. It really is. Even though it's generally nice, I've been very careful not to draw myself into that too much, because I've seen how it destroys people and subverts them, and I just thought, be careful of that, because you think, oh yeah, I'm not bothered, I won't succumb to that. Yeah, but I've been careful of it, very careful not to watch the numbers, let's put it that way.
Right, well, I've actually had to discipline myself, not to look at the numbers with this podcast, because it's triggering for me, and of course I rationalise and justify, oh, I want to be professional, keep an eye on, you know, blah blah blah, but it's simply too emotionally charged for me, and just facing up to that and admitting
that really
that
surprises me, Jason, honestly. I just can't imagine it. You just seem so
well, you probably haven't paid much attention then to my
I
work,
haven't, Jason,
because I mean, I appreciate what you're saying, because I agree that, like, in myself I'm pretty centered and grounded, and
yeah,
more
brilliant.
And more so, but I would say that that's inseparable from actually recognizing and becoming conscious of and owning up to that hungry fragment that just needs endless validation, and talking about it, like, it's been a thread through my, you know, public work slash play for years now, really, just exposing my own neurotic needs and passions.
Well, I am aware of that. You and I have one or two friends, stroke listeners in common, I think, and
yeah,
one or two of those people have said, oh, you might want to listen to this. So I have come across things again. I'll tell you, before we, excuse me, move on, the big difference that it's made for me, Jason, in terms of seeking acknowledgement and not seeking it, is the acknowledgement that I do get is from physical people in front of me, right, in my life. And I think if I didn't have that, it might be a different story. Mm-hmm. So I've also been very careful to maintain and nurture real relationships with people who I actually see and sit with and talk to and love and share and all that. Sounds a bit cheesy.
AFK, isn't it? Away from keyboard.
Yeah. And when one of those people puts their hand on my shoulder and says, you know, that was pretty good, that thing you did the other day, that's worth a fucking million likes or tweets. It really is. And I just think, ha, that is lovely. It is lovely. And I think getting that physically on a regular basis, just, you know, in a friendly way, not in a adoring way, but by people who know me and who, as well as recognize me, can also criticize me and say, what the fuck was that you were talking about the other day? You made a right mess of that, or something like that, and I can laugh about it. That is another grounding element, and I think if I didn't have those people in my life, I'd be more looking to the outside and looking to the numbers on the screen for that. Not a lot, but a little bit. So there's definitely an element to that. So
sure. Well, that's quite apropos, because where I'm at with the renovations and settling and putting roots and all that stuff that I mentioned already is setting up a local business of sorts that will mean participating with the community. And I've been very aware that, oh, well, this is going to, you know, this hungry, endless quest for fame, which I know is endemic to everyone in the Western world now, but is stronger in me because I was born into entitlement. I was born in a kind of closet aristocracy.
Yes,
so I was conditioned with this belief of that it was my birthright to be a somebody, capital S, and it's been really fucking hard to get free of that. My brother, he destroyed my brother. I mean,
I know, I'm sorry to hear of that, Jason.
Literally consumed him, and I'm the age he was when he died. I'm now older than he ever got to be, and I was aware of that when he crashed and burned, that it was, you know, a very real danger for myself. Like, if I didn't fully acknowledge and integrate that part of me in time, then it would also possess me and destroy me. And I think this is a very real phenomenon. We could get metaphysical about it if we wanted, but, you know, no need to, but perhaps. But so, yeah, just being like, oh, well, if I can, it's a very small town I live in, if I can just be a presence in that community and affect people's lives in a positive way and get that direct feedback, I know without any doubt that the need, as you put it, for tweets and likes and all the rest of it is going to become irrelevant.
It totally will transform, and I say that with respect, and, you know, I don't know how you do things, but I would say it would do. I've not grown up in entitlement. I grew up in a working class family who just became, quote, a middle class family due to my father's career and profession. And it was like my grandfather was a steel worker, and my other grandfather was a high school teacher. And then before that, you know, one was a coal miner, you know, for Christ's sake. So you can't get more physical than steel and coal, right? So for me, as someone in our family, to be earning a living in an abstract way is very strange. I'm sure you must think this too. It often strikes me that the essence of what I do is utterly intangible. It's ethereal. It's even inexplicable to some people who don't have a philosophical bent. It's hard to tell them what I do. But I have a very... well, a slightly romantic view of it, that it's nice to consider oneself from time to time that, you know, like the old Greek philosophers, whose job was, in certain quarters at least, simply to wander around and or sit peacefully and say things and contemplate, and people would sit next to them and say, what are you thinking about and what does this mean? And they'd say, oh, you know, I don't know, maybe this, maybe that. And I think, what a lovely thing to do that is. What a joyful livelihood, what a luxury that is, particularly, of course, now in a modern age. So part of my project with being Neil Kramer has been to try and make that a little bit of a reality in what I do. To say, yes, we're just saying stuff, really. We're just thinking and sharing thoughts, and that is a legitimate thing to do, not to be doing things and having bloody projects all the time, but just to be gently contemplative. And I think people love that. And they look to people like you and I sometimes as a beacon for that, to think, you know, you can get these guys to talk about anything. Jason can talk about his plumbing. I like bird watching, for example. That's very geeky, isn't it? And Neil Kramer podcast about raptors on the Pacific coast, you know, the turkey vulture and the bald eagle and the red-tailed hawks. I'd be, if somebody said, here's $1 million, your job from now on is as an ornithologist, I'd go, great, and I'd drop this overnight.
So I get a bit of voice of scepticism now.
Okay.
Because I just listened to Talking to Henry, and the part two of the show, I listened to both parts, but
at
the end of part two,
yes,
you were waxing quite eloquently and quite, dare I say, grandiloquently, if that's the right pronunciation, about multiple communities across the world of centres of excellence.
Oh, yes, yes.
Bring about the new, what, Teutonic age of the Ubermensch, or...
Just colleges of learning for people who want to accelerate the growth. So think about how hard your path's been and what you've learned. And if a young man came up to you and said, Jason, you're a wise man, help me grow.
I would say, stop right there.
Yeah, stop, well, listen, right there. Let me just say this.
Yeah.
And they say, help me grow. What pointers can you give me? You know, what are the dead ends and what are the smooth, you know, rivers flowing freely that are good to paddle down? If somebody came to me, I could say, fucking hell, sit down, put your pen down and just listen, and I can talk to you for a little while, and then you can go away and come back in 10 years and see what's happened. But we can help, just like there's lots of people who can help and say, there are ways of doing things that make it easier. You don't have to learn through suffering. That's been the way at the present time on this planet, I think. And it has been in my life, and I think it has been in yours too.
Definitely.
But it doesn't have to be like that. There's another way of doing it. And so I think we chose suffering, knowing that we just had that millimeter extra strength to survive it, whereas most people cannot. And you just about do it and think, right, I'm finally kind of seeing that this endless bloody polarization does indeed serve a sort of purpose and bring a degree of insight and wisdom. And for me, there's definitely things, let me give you a hard example. If somebody had said to me, you can only be loved to the degree that you love yourself. If someone had told me that at 15, things would have been a lot easier. That's a little gem that no one fucking told me, which I've had to learn the hard way, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it helps, though, if somebody tells us things, because we tend to ignore it anyway.
Well, do we, though, depending on who it is? If it's your bloody geography teacher at high school, you think, yeah, fucking shut up, whatever. But if it's somebody who has walked it...
Who's embodying it, yeah, for sure.
Who's embodying it, and the scars on the face to show it, which I have and you have.
So, but that somebody would probably need to be our father, I think, for it to really land
not at
home.
All. Oh, goodness me, no. That I agree there's a paternal and maternal aspect, but it's archetypal. It's not. I don't think it has to be biological. It would simply be a school where you would go, like any other school, and learn and become attached to some teachers, and there'd be semesters and there'd be courses and some would be better than others. But the standard of excellence would be very high. And you'd say, this is where we go to learn and focus and gather. And I'll tell you what the main principle of it is. It's nothing sophisticated. It's simple. People don't gather enough, period. So if somebody gave me a wadge of money and said, go and make a mystical college, I'd say, yes, please. But top of the list would be creating a high-quality space for people to just come and hang out, period. Not just any schmuck, but people who are serious about their own development and their own life and want to be better, want to be more whole, and want to resolve issues and dissolve impurities. You say, well, there's this place, and there's like 10 guys who teach there, and, you know, 10 women, whatever, and it's pretty good. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. I don't know of any other place. And that's what I'm talking about, is that, as far as I can see, traveling around a little bit, I've never seen that. So I would love to create a place like that.
Well, don't you think it's been tried, though, many countless times over the millennia?
No,
because
no,
this is not.
No.
I mean, this.
Oh,
is
over the millennia.
Yeah,
yes.
This is certainly something that I've thought about, and I attempted it in my 20s, right before I disinherited my whole fortune, and more recently been hanging in Finland, as I said, with Dave O'Shaughnessy, an enlightenment coach, and these retreats, like 7-day retreats, and we've even talked about doing an intentional community. And well, where am I at now with it? Just that I think, and this is when I was listening to you on Red Eyes, like I listened about 3 hours yesterday, so I left it a bit late. I got a Kramer overload.
Yeah.
Overdose, even.
Yeah. And one has to be very careful about such things.
Absolutely. And it did actually make me quite tense about today. I was really looking forward to it, but then when I got a lot of, you know, listened to a lot of what you're saying, there was a lot, to be frank, that I disagreed with and I found disturbing in there.
Yeah, that's all right.
I figured you wouldn't mind. I mean, you're aware that you're propagating dangerous ideas, I think.
Yeah, hopefully.
Right. So, but specifically in the context of what we're saying now, the use of the word will, like you're very into will, I think you're connected to individuality and, you know, coming into our own individual soul expression and how that relates to the use and the appliance of will. And
yeah.
Obviously, need to say this is a huge topic, but in terms of what we're talking about now, that's pretty much where I'm at, that anything that is brought about through will is going to encounter exactly the same problems that we're trying to avoid. Like if we use will to try and solve things, then inevitably we make things worse through that attempt. Because I would say that will is actually not the solution but the problem, like the will to power.
Gosh.
Right?
Well, it depends what you mean by will, doesn't it? And I bet you.
Yeah.
We don't mean the same thing.
I think we probably do. I mean, like,
well, go on,
I've got the Castanedian sense of will as it's an energy rather than a mental thing. So I think we probably agree on that. We're not talking.
Not for me. That's not what I'm talking
okay,
about.
Okay, why don't you go first then?
I will, because I don't want you to say loads of
right.
excellent things and I just go no, like a big girl. Mm-hmm. Let me respectfully answer your question. Will is God's will. It's not man's will. That's the big difference for me.
What if I don't believe in God?
Well, then you can go and fix your house up and enjoy that.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that I would say is the body's will. For me, like, the will is I guess, to answer your definition, is an expression of the body.
Yeah, and I hear you, and I understand that. For me, the only thing that we have that's ours, ironically, which is the reverse of what many people think, is mind. So mind, we have half of it, and that's from the animal. The heart is like what I consider the soul bit of you. So your heart is your sort of bridge to your soul,
mm-hmm.
which is very transcendental in nature, and is to do with merging things. But the bit of us that's, quote, divine or from source or really eternal is will. And it's not yours or mine. It's not the animal's will. So perhaps that might explain what the fuck I'm talking about. You know, again, sincerely saying that to you, not to try and debate or argue. I couldn't care less. But to me, it was, if I thought it was man's will, I wouldn't say what I'm saying. But if anybody finds that interesting and digs into what I'm saying on these, you know, workshops and stuff and downloads, Alchemy of Will, the will really is a shard of divinity that says, there you go, off you go with that for a million years and go and do stuff and come back and let me know what you saw, what did you witness with your piece of will that for a period of time you had freedom with and you could choose your own actions and destructions and creations and whatever you want, and then come back and tell me about it.
So is that soul then, synonymous with soul?
No. Soul, is I see, is really just a container for identity. So identity traits and patterns.
So that's very not eternal then?
No, definitely not. No, it is finite. So the only thing that is eternal is this divine will. And I use God, I know that's a very big word to unpack or whatever, but let's just say something divine.
It sounds that, like a doing, though. Sorry, and we're going to get into rapid-fire stuff, but wills to me implies, and
we are using language,
so obviously we know it comes with baggage. Sure. So will, wouldn't you say that it implies doing, it implies action?
Yes, I would. I'd have to agree with that. The essence of will is something outside of oneself, which is not yours. The manifestation of will is action, which is don't just talk about stuff, do it.
So that's where my problem comes in, because to me the eternal...
Well, tell me what it is, because honestly, it's refreshing to hear this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's not like I work this out in advance. I always say this to Neil and I got my bullet points. No, I just want to talk to Neil and see what comes up. And we're talking about the eternal essence. To me, that would be soul, but that doesn't matter. That's semantic. But if it's eternal, then it's not temporal. Therefore, it doesn't do anything. There's no doing involved. So then, that would be where I start to question. Well, hold on. Which part of Neil, or which part of me, or which part of anyone, is wanting to do? Is wanting to use or apply will?
Yeah.
As it can't be that eternal part, because the eternal part simply is. And there's no doing it. There's nothing to be done, right?
Thank you. I grasp what you're saying now. Right. Yes, let me just say something about that for a minute. Anything that is infinite and that is eternal is, to use the old language, is unbegotten, is unmanifested, and therefore there can be no doing, right? So I utterly agree. And when you sort of blend into that, it's very much a not doing. And it's the closest we might say is a being, or a not doing. But it's definitely not a doing, I agree, right? But part of the art project, we'll use that term, which I often say, is to express. And expression for the animal is a doing. Mm. And that occurs through mind, which is a human facet for us here, half of it, and soul and will. So I have this three-tier way of thinking about it. It's not some great model. It's presented necessarily. It's a way of thinking that mind and heart and will together constitute what I call the heavenly animal, which is what you should be doing. So it should be blood and piss and shit, and it should be heavenly and celestial and ethereal and ephemeral. It should be.
And where's the body in that trinity?
The body is a manifestation of will. To me,
the
body is a vision of the will. It's a thought. It's I hardly dare say the word tulpa to you. It's a thought form. It's a tulpa, right? So the body is a divine vision, and it's so incredible, and so such a close tutor, and such a loving ally, and yet it's always overlooked by everybody. But not if I have anything to do with it.
The body.
So, the body. Hmm. The body being central to your learning process. So the two most important elements in one's growth for me is the body and the sun. And they're the things that people see every day and never see, never notice, never look at. So I'm always banging on about the sun at workshops and events and that. Hmm. My stuff. So it's important to understand that will isn't nothing to do necessarily with how Nietzsche would say it. He was a very fragmented and unhappy and loveless man. And that factors into what he can perceive. Without love, some things are not perceptible. Another thing someone could have told me at 15, that would have been easier.
That was the first part of my conversation with Neil Kramer. You can listen to part 2, as well as the outtakes, next Wednesday, the 27th of May. This podcast is a labor of love. There's no subscriber section. This podcast will always be free, as far as I know. If you do want to help keep this podcast going, you can make a donation monthly via patreon.com/liminalist or a one-time donation at the blog link at the website horticulture.com. Otherwise, I appreciate any and all feedback. Come to the forum kubricon.com/maze or comment at the blog or at the website where you downloaded this audio, or email me at jason@horticulture.com. Till next week, this is The Liminalists.